Hey, good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Wow. I'm all ready to go now, especially since I don't think I got to sleep before 3 o'clock this morning. So that woke me up. That was great. I needed that. And the reason that I didn't get to sleep until 3 o'clock this morning is that a friend of ours, in fact, she's sitting right back there, Danielle, gifted us with tickets to go see Carole King and James Taylor last night. Wow, at the Hollywood Bowl. 18,000 baby boomers in one place. It was amazing. All 40 and 50-somethings there just having the best, most polite and civil time that you can imagine. No mosh pits, no dancing in the aisles. They're too old for that kind of thing. But it was absolutely amazing just to... Between those two, I think they wrote a third of all the pop songs in the world. It was amazing what was going on. Just so much stuff. And it was funny because at the end, begging for an encore, you know, this is L.A. It's green. Nobody smokes anymore. Not cigarettes, not anything else. Nothing was going on. And so at the end, when they're begging for the encore, everybody was flashing their iPods, their iPhones. So they're holding up their iPhones and waving those back and forth because nobody has cigarette lighters anymore. In fact, there was a guy behind us who had an app for his iPhone that was a cigarette lighter. And so he was holding that one up too and showing us. So there's an app for that, in case you were wondering. But it was an amazing time, just to hear his voice, to hear what an acoustic guitar is supposed to sound like, and just kind of enter into that. I don't know if it strikes you the same way, but songs and music are kind of like. Scents, you know, a smell that just brings back a memory, brings back exactly where you are and where you were at a specific time and place. It's amazing how it does that. And I remember at a really difficult, probably the worst time in my life, I listened to a lot of James Taylor because I realized that you can't listen to James Taylor and be depressed at the same time. And last night I confirmed that. You can't listen to James Taylor and be depressed at the same time. But you can be cold. I forgot my jacket. But it was just amazing to hear all these songs and to hear, you know, the interaction between the band and between Carole King and James Taylor. And I was thinking at the same time, you know, they've been making songs for 50 years. And what does it feel like to walk out on stage and see 18,000 people who are there for you? And to know that over the last 50 years, you have been an intimate part of so many people's lives in ways that you'll never know or understand. Now, that's pretty awesome. When you think about the meaning and purpose that would give you, that you would think would give you, it sort of boggles the mind for the rest of us. But you know, even rock stars have to go back to the hotel room alone. And what happens at night in the dark, you know, when the demons come and you can't sleep, where's your meaning and purpose then? Does it carry through? Well, I think we know the answer to that because so many of our top celebrities and famous people seem to have the most tragic lives and have difficulties. You know, life is sort of a what have you done for me lately sort of affair. Have you ever thought about it that way? You know, one moment you've got 18,000 people flashing iPhones at you, and the next moment you're alone in the dark. And how do we square that? And where does meaning and purpose come from anyway? And how do we retain it? And how do we know when we've really got it? Got it for real? Have meaning and purpose and a sense of who we are and why we're here in a way that transcends, you know, the ups and downs of life and the fleeting this and that. And all these things were kind of running through my head. We've been talking about the beloved. We've been talking about rites of passage. We've been talking about how it is that we negotiate this journey. But it's an ephemeral thing. It's a delicate, fragile thing to find a meaning and a purpose that really is solid, permanent, you know, puts a foundation under our feet that we can count on. And this is what I'm after, you know. I'm not interested in something that is not going to take me through the most difficult times of my life anymore. Used to be. It used to be about just anesthetizing whatever the pain was. You know, just make it go away for another 24-hour period so I can get through. But it's not good enough. it goes away. I was counseling a young married couple, 20-something couple, and one of the concerns of the wife is that her husband is not passionate about spiritual issues, passionate about his faith, passionate about moving forward, and she feels alone. She feels that all this is on her side, and none of it's on his side. And she's worried about how that's going to play out in their marriage. I had another call just a couple of weeks ago requesting a marriage later on in the summer. And it was the mother calling for her daughter and the fiancé. And then she wanted to talk about the fact that he's Catholic and she's Protestant. And is that going to make them unequally yoked? You know, and she's worried about that. And, you know, would I even perform such a ceremony, you know, between a Catholic and a Protestant? You know, it's funny, as we look back on that passage that Paul wrote in 2 Corinthians, you know, about, you know, don't become unequally yoked with non-believers. It's funny how Catholics have become sort of non-believers in our estimation. But that passage doesn't even specifically talk about marriage, although, you know, he probably had that in mind. It harkens back to Deuteronomy, where God is telling the people not to yoke an ox and a donkey together. You know, and there's a good reason for that. You know, an ox is always going to outpull a donkey. So unless you're trying to plow crop circles or something, that's probably not a good idea. But as far as hard and fast rules, you know, as she was telling me about the fiance, you know, he's a Catholic, but he's not really practicing. He's completely respectful and understanding of his wife's faith. He goes with her to church at times, although they spend a lot of time not going to church as well. But what I was trying to point out to her, that the business of being unequally yoked is not just allegiance to a particular religion. Although that can create logistical difficulties, sure. You know, one of our relatives married a Jewish woman, and that was hard. Because how do you raise the children? Especially when the family is devout and, you know, the other family is Catholic. And, you know, there are difficulties. But going back to the first couple, the first thing that I wanted to ask the young man, the husband, was, first of all, do you agree with that? Does that sound like she's saying something that jives with your side of things? And he said, well, yeah. He says, you know, I just don't think about those things very much. It's just not something that I really pay a lot of attention to. And so first question I wanted to ask him was, if I asked you who you are, would you be able to answer that question? And he says, no, I have no idea. And I knew what the answer would be before he asked. Because when we're not paying attention to these things, when we're not taking them seriously, we have no idea who we are. Now, 20 years ago, when I was in that man's shoes, that young man's shoes, I not only had no idea who I was, I didn't even know what the question meant. What does it mean, who am I? I could, you know, so you ask me the question, I'm going to tell you, okay, I'm a father, I'm a son, I'm a brother, I'm a, you know, I'm an uncle, I'm this, I'm that. Maybe I'd go lapse into what I do. I'm a communication specialist. I'm a teacher. I'm a musician. I'm this and that. But the relationships and the roles we play and the things that we accomplish or the things that we do for life have nothing to do with who we really are. That's a completely separate question. And if you haven't really considered it, if it isn't a focus in your life, if it isn't something that drives you to find out, then you're always going to be unable to even define the question. And then the follow-up question to that is, why are you here? And of course, he had no idea about that either. And I was trying to instill in him a desire to want to seek answers to the basic existential questions of life. You know, he's only in his mid-late 20s, but I told him, you're approaching a midlife, not necessarily a crisis yet, but midlife issues. And what are midlife issues? They're crises of meaning and purpose. Meaning, who am I? Purpose, why am I here? You know, if we can't answer those questions, if we haven't even thought through them, there's going to be a hole in our heart. There's going to be a deep longing, a deep unrequited love, if you want to think of it that way. There's going to be a deep unmet expectation. There is going to be all of the fear and anxiety and stress, even if it's deeply covered up by everything that you do in life, that will cause you to act out in certain ways. You have to anesthetize that pain. It can't go unresolved. And if we don't deal with it when the real midlife crisis comes in the mid-30s, then it just keeps coming back as more and more of a cartoon character. You know, until we really are buying the red sports cars and having the affairs. Why? Because we're making a return to infantile behavior. We're returning back to the safe world of the child. And so really, to be unequally yoked is more an equal yoking of desire, levels of desire. The wife here desired more. She was striving to find out something that made sense to her in terms of her spiritual nature. Is everything that we see and everything that we can touch, is that really all there is? Or is there something more? And if so, how do I relate to that something more? And he had not yet entered into the place where he was really starting to look and delve into those things. And that can create a real loneliness. Because there are some things that are so deep and so intimate, if they're not shared by those closest to us, it creates barriers, and there's no way around that. And so, we've been talking about rites of passage as the vehicle by which we can graduate deeper into this knowing, deeper into this understanding. But a problem is that we want to understand it intellectually. We want to get all the questions. We want to read the manual, read the book, figure it out, you know, as if that has anything to do with the actual experience of life. The existential questions, the who am I questions, the why am I here questions aren't understood with our minds. They're understood with the experience of our lives. And once you have the answers, you can't give them to anybody else. If you ask me who I am, I've got an answer for you, and it makes perfect sense to me. And it's given me a solid foundation under my feet that I can count on. Not that I don't get depressed, of course I do. But I don't get depressed for decades at a time anymore. They don't take me to my absolute knees anymore so that I can't function. And when I feel the edges and the grain is coming, sometimes I can ward them off before they even get here. And if I can't, usually within a few days, sometimes a few hours, I can come back out again. That's a big difference that happened without me even being aware of it. See, we can't sneak up on the big existential questions. They sort of sneak up on us. It's what happens as we're just living our lives fully immersed, not retreating from the pain or the difficult things. And that's what a rite of passage actually is. We talked about it having three parts, essential parts, that our culture doesn't have these three essential parts in any of our rites of passage anymore. And that is separation, transition, and reincorporation. The separation is the wounding. The separation is the cutting off from the safe, familiar world, whatever it happens to be. If it's a coming-of-age rite of passage, and it's the world of the child. If it's a starting of a new job, it's the cutting off from the old job where we felt that we were able to accomplish what we were accomplishing. Or if it's a graduation, it's a moving into a new world that has different rules that we're unsure of, that scares us. And then a moving through that, finding out that we can be equal to the task, and then reincorporation back into the relationships that mean so much to us. And so a rite of passage is exactly the same thing as the hero's journey, and we've talked about that in here before. And that's another essential way. If we can start to see our lives with us as the hero in it, imagine what that changes in the way that you perceive and deal with the difficulties that arise. The hero's journey is similar in shape to the rite of passage. You know, the hero is called out of his or her familiar safe world by some wounding, by some happenstance, by something, and thrown into this world where all the rules are different, where there's usually magical beings and dragons and demons and angelic characters and all of this stuff that we don't understand. And a guide appears and helps the hero along. And there are tasks and difficult things that have to be accomplished. And if the hero is equal to the task, gets a gift, a boon, an understanding, a foundation that he or she can bring back to the community and gift everyone else with as well. And for me, the classic is always The Wizard of Oz. You know? Because we all understand it, it's shorthand for it, and Dorothy has all of the characteristics of the hero. You know, there is a wounding in her. There is something that is causing her to want so badly to go someplace else. And what I want to point out to you is this desire this heart's desire, is the engine that carries us through our lives, carries us through our rites of passage and our hero's journey. Without this intense desire, there's no place to go. Think about it. If you're happy, if you're content, if you want for nothing, where do you want to go? Nowhere. You want to stay right where you are. It's the wounding that kickstarts the journey to the next level. There's always got to be a wounding. We see it as an evil thing, but it's not really. It's what happens. Dorothy has no parents. We don't know where she comes from. Is she an orphan? What happened? Most likely an orphan. She's living with her aunt and uncle. You know, she's not a farmhand. You know, she's about as useful on the farm as hen droppings on a pump handle. You know, there is just no use for her. And at the beginning of the story, we find that she is just causing trouble on the farm. You know, and finally, her Aunt Em says to her, find yourself a place where you won't get into any trouble. It's right there in your bulletin. Find yourself a place where you won't get into any trouble. Now, that can be taken a lot of different ways. And Dorothy takes it the second way. Dorothy says, some place where there isn't any trouble. Do you suppose there is such a place, Toto? There must be, but it's not a place you can get to by a boat or a train. It's far, far away, behind the moon, beyond the rain. And if you don't recognize it, that's a music cue, and she goes into Somewhere Over the Rainbow. This heart's longing, this desire to be somewhere else, where these rules don't apply anymore because she's just sick of them. She's bored. There's something missing. And so she's called out. She runs away, but she immediately meets Professor Marvel, who is one of her guides along the way. And he shows her Auntie M's distress, and so she tries to return, tries to go back. And this is a key element to the hero's journey, because when the call is made, when we are called to move forward, sometimes we refuse the call, don't we? And when we refuse the call, things in our life go static, because we know at some level that we are supposed to be moving forward, and when we're not, it's going toxic and it's eating away at us. All of the obsessive compulsive things we do are a result of the refusal to answer the call, to move forward to the next level. And the pain keeps increasing until it's unbearable, and we have to do something. Sometimes we call it hitting bottom. Sometimes we call it, you know, having a nervous breakdown, having a divorce, whatever it is. But eventually we get to the point where we can no longer contain this, and we've got to move. In Dorothy's case, the twister does the work for her and takes her to Oz, where she ends up in this world that she doesn't understand, and all she wants to do is to get home again. And she meets people along the way that help her. Glinda is the good witch, gives her the ruby slippers, doesn't tell her what they're good for, just gives them to her, says, keep tight inside them. You know? Then she meets her traveling companions, Scarecrow, Tin Woodman, Lion, who are really only extensions of herself. You know? They're the outward expressions of her own intellect, of her own compassion and mercy, of her own courage and fortitude, being developed as she moves through. Go see the wizard, they say. Go see the wizard. And along the way, she meets the cabbie at the Emerald City, who is Professor Marvel, and the doorman, who is Professor Marvel, and eventually the wizard himself, who is Professor Marvel. This is her guide. This is her person who brings her through. Go bring back the broomstick of the Wicked Witch of the West, he says. She has to pass that test. And when she comes back, she realizes that everything that she needed to complete these tasks, everything that she needed to find her heart's desire, she had at the beginning. And at the end, she says these fascinating things. You know, Glinda the Good Witch says the most frustrating thing in the whole movie. You know, you can go home anytime you want. Those shoes will take you there. Why didn't you tell me that in the first place? She had to learn for herself. And the Woodman asks her, what have you learned, Dorothy? Now there's a question. When you've gone through your life, what have you learned, Dorothy? And she says, well, I think that it wasn't enough to just want to see Uncle Henry and Auntie M. And it's that if I ever go looking for my heart's desire again, I won't look any further than my own backyard. Because if it isn't there, I really never lost it to begin with. Is that right? You bet it is. The kingdom isn't out there to be observed, to be seen, there it is, or here it comes. The kingdom is within. The kingdom is here. The kingdom is now. Jesus was trying to turn his world on its head by saying the kingdom isn't coming out there someplace with an army to kick out the Romans. The kingdom is already here. I am here. You know, what is our heart's desire? The Psalms are full of the notion of the heart's desire. Psalm 20, may he grant you your heart's desire and fulfill all your counsel. Psalm 38, Lord, all my desire is before you, and my sighing is not hidden from you. It is natural for us to desire. It is essential for us to desire. It is essential for us to desire deeply. The question is, what do we think we desire? You know, when it comes right down to it, you heard of a heat-seeking missile? We're all pleasure-seeking missiles. That's what we do. We go through life seeking pleasure and avoiding pain. It's what we do. You know, I've said this before, and some people got really incensed when I said it, you know, because it sounds so amoral. You know, I'm more than that. You know, I'm willing to forego what I need and forego what I want. But think about it. If you're doing that, you're only going for a greater pleasure than the one that you thought that you had, that you're letting go of now. We are always seeking pleasure and avoiding pain. It's the way we're wired. It's the way that we're engineered. It's the way it's supposed to be. The question is, what is it that you take pleasure in? That's the only question that we have to answer. And are we able to see past all the little pleasures to the ultimate pleasure that will give us that foundation that we're talking about, and not the one that just masks the pain, deadens the call so that we don't answer and go where it is that we're being pushed to go, that our lives are calling us to go, out of the world of the child, into the world of adult, the scary world. Can we go there? What do we take pleasure in? John 17, Jesus says, Father, I desire, my heart's desire is that they also, whom you have given me, be with me where I am, so that they may see my glory which you have given me, for you loved me before the foundation of the world. Jesus' greatest desire is unity, to be with us, to share with us, to show us what is possible in his kingdom, what is possible in this life that his Father has given us. Romans 10:1, Paul, brethren, my heart's desire and my prayer to God for them is for their salvation. Same thing. Unity, connection. Use your pleasure-seeking device inside for good instead of evil. It's redefining what we take pleasure in. It's looking through and seeing what it is that is going to give us what we are truly seeking. That's the most important thing for us. You know, there's one other concept I would like to lay over on top of this. The rite of passage, the hero's journey, that may help us. Scott Peck, the famous psychologist and author of Road Less Traveled and The Different Drum, he talks about the stages of growth in the faith life, the stages of spiritual growth. And he has a fascinating observation that as a clinical psychologist, he would watch people come into his office, and if they came in and they were deeply religious, when they went through the process, when they went through all of the clinical psychoanalytical therapy that they went through, if they took it seriously and they really went through it and they got better, they got healthier and they got to the other side, guess what happened? They lost their faith. They lost their deeply held religious convictions. And yet, if people came in without deeply held religious convictions and did exactly the same thing, same therapy, same therapist, same process, going through, got better, got healthier, they ended up on the other side of the process finding faith and deeply held religious convictions. What in the world is going on? He wanted to know. How could this be? Same process. They either gain faith or they lose it depending on where they started. And then what he did was superimpose this idea of these stages of faith that made it all make sense. And the one who wrote the book on it is James Fallow. And he had six stages. They're kind of wonky and kind of clinical. Put them and condense them down to four that make a lot more sense, I think, for our purposes. And the first one he called chaos. It's basically the natural person. I think of natural woman. That's what she's saying last night. Yeah. You make me feel like a natural woman. Well, you know, the natural woman, the natural man is really, you know, it's a person who is basically their heart's desire is survival. You know, anything that you need to do to survive is okay. You know, it's ethical if it's survival. It's just this basic manipulation and using of all the tools at hand and all the people at hand in order to get you where you need to go. It's just the natural state. It's really the state of the child. You know, children are the biggest narcissists on the planet, you know, and they're supposed to be at that stage. We're supposed to move out of that, and sometimes we don't answer that call either. But, you know, it's that narcissistic and the identification. If the heart's desire is salvation, the identification is with self. All right? And even if there is a religious veneer, if there is an association or allegiance to a religious group, it's still just using the trappings of religion to further the survival process. And so that person is someone that you cannot have a relationship with because their identification is with their self. If you can graduate to stage two is defined by the group, by the tribe. Stage two is the person now identifying with a church, with a religion, with a theology, with a creed. If it's in the religious setting, it could be in a political setting. But the stage two person is the one who is craving and desiring security. And that's why they identify with the group. The need for security is so overwhelming that they have to build walls that are very thick around them. You know, these are the fundamentalists among us. These are the ones who can't tolerate someone having a different point of view because that's threatening to their security. You know, this is how I am saved. This is the formulation that works. And anything outside of that is threatening and cannot be tolerated and must be converted, even if it's by the sword, even if it's by fire. The world must be safe, you know, for my religion, for my understanding. And if you graduate from that, you move to stage three. And stage three is the realm of the skeptic, the agnostic, sometimes even the self-proclaimed atheist, the someone who doesn't know anymore. But these people can sometimes be even more spiritual than stage two, because really the heart's desire of the stage three person is truth. They are stage two people who have been mugged. And their faith did not sustain them. And what good is it anymore? And they throw it away. But their desire is for truth. It's something that they want so badly that they identify with their ethics. Stage three people can be deeply ethical. Stage three people can have deeply held causes that they support. They can be very charitable. But they do it in a non-religious way. They do it in a way that has nothing to do with the group anymore. You know, they're doing this individualistically and trying to find the truth as they go. And then there's stage four. And stage four is the mystic. Stage four is the person who is completely communal and united with everybody, regardless of their tradition, regardless of their stated faith. The stage four person is the one who relates on a heart-to-heart, spirit-to-spirit level with God. They have answered those questions that we're talking about. Who am I? Why am I here? To their own satisfaction. And they have a foundation under their feet that allows them to be able to be free, to take the risk, to love everyone, regardless of their stripes. And so if you think back to Scott Peck's dilemma, when he got people into his office who were stage two, as they got better, they graduated to stage three, and it looked like they lost their faith. But if you got someone in stage three who seemed to have no faith, they graduated to stage four, where they became deeply spiritual, but in a more universal sort of way, not bounded just by the church or just by the theology. Here's the key. Each one of those stages are stages we can go through, but everybody's different. They're not neat categories. We're in mixtures. We're on the cusp. We're moving. Sometimes, you know, the church's dilemma is how do you get people from stage 2 to stage 4 without having to pass through stage 3? You know, we don't want them to go through stage 3. How do you get them to make that leap? You know, sometimes it's just not possible. Most times, it's just not possible. It's the natural progression to go through these things. How do we graduate from stage to stage? If we're perfectly happy in one stage, are we ever going to go to the next? No, it's the cumulative experiences of our lives that create the pressure. It's like filling the vessel that you're in until the breaking point, and you're feeling that pressure. You all know those times in your lives when things just get so crazy and you get so stressed out. And if we can start to see those as times where we're going to break out of that vessel into the next bigger space, then how much easier would it be to deal with those and to bear with those things? It's our desire for more that continues to push us through. I remember when I landed in the evangelical church 20 years ago, after having to listen to James Taylor to keep me from killing myself, I wanted so much to be on the inside looking out. I did not want to be outside anymore. I felt like I'd spent my whole life on the outside looking in. And I just wanted to land in stage 2 and just build my really thick walls and just be safe. That's all I wanted. Can I have that, please? And I got kicked right out of the nest again, you know, and I had to deal with all these issues again. Now I look back and I'm so grateful, because I could have spent a decade or two probably in stage 2. I was so tired at that time. But I got kicked out of the nest and I had to go through my stage 3. Where I didn't know if I could or would or wanted to be a Christian. I didn't know who this Jesus was or if he was anyone that I wanted to get to know at that point. And in that search through that barren wasteland of stage 3, I found a Jesus that I can follow to the ends of the earth and beyond. But he wasn't the Jesus I thought I knew growing up Catholic, or the Jesus that I was being taught in my stage 2 church. But what I have found has allowed me to open up, to relax. This is the journey that we're on. This is the shape of the journey that we're on. Jesus was the ultimate stage 4 person, stage 6 person, stage whatever you want to call him. But he would sit down with anybody. It didn't matter. You have to fix him before he sat down with you. He would just sit down with you. Didn't matter if you were a Samaritan or a Roman or a prostitute or a tax collector. Drove the establishment crazy because they were stage 2. You know, you had to follow this law. You had to stay away from anybody who didn't think the way we did or do what we do. And Jesus was breaking all those rules. He is telling us that our desire can drive us through. If our heart's desire is for what his heart's desire is, at John 17, for unity, for connection with each other, we can move through exactly what he is moving through. Taking us, showing us how to get to this place where everything starts to make sense again for the first time. But at least we can move through the difficulties in our life with a sense of equilibrium, with a contentment that can take us. But I'll tell you what, at times it feels like it all goes away. I don't care how advanced you think you are. And maybe the more advanced you think you are, the more you're going to hit a block wall that just takes you back again. But even then, this is where Thomas Merton comes to my rescue. This prayer of Thomas Merton, this famous prayer, is sort of the ground of all being when it comes to heart's desire. He says, "My Lord God, I have no idea where I am going. I do not see the road ahead of me. I cannot know for certain where it will end, nor do I really know myself. And the fact that I think I am following your will does not mean that I'm actually doing so. But I believe that the desire to please you does in fact please you. The desire to please you does in fact please you. And I hope that I have that desire in all that I am doing. I hope that I will never do anything apart from that desire. And I know that if I do this, you will lead me by the right road, though I may know nothing about it. Therefore, I will trust you always, though I may seem to be lost and in the shadow of death. I will not fear, for you are ever with me, and you will never leave me to face my perils alone. Everyone, when it seems that everything else is lost, do you still have your desire? That's all we need. Jesus said, ask, seek, and knock. Selu, Bea, and Koshv in Aramaic. Ask, seek, and knock. Not passively, you know, not intellectually. Selu, to ask, means like a police interrogation. There is an urgency behind it. There is a desire behind it. It's related by root to selah, which is the word for prayer, which means to clear a space and to wait expectantly for something to happen. It's that kind of asking. To seek, bea, is an intense search from inside to outside. Not the other way around, from inside to outside. It's a clearing of everything that would stand in the way from us to be able to find our heart's desire. And then finally, koshf, which is the weirdest one of all. It means to strike a note, like a musical note, or pitch a tent. It means to make something real, make something apprehendable to somebody else that wasn't before. It means to realize. It means at the end of our asking and our seeking, there is a space that we create in which something real, genuine happens, something authentic. This is the path, and we can do it if, as long as we are stoked with our desire. If there is nothing else that we do in here, if there is nothing else that we accomplish except to stoke the desire of our hearts, to want to know our God, to want to understand the nature of our relationship with Him, to want to be able to answer those questions to our own satisfaction, meaning, who am I? Purpose, why am I here? It's all we need. It's the wind in our sails. It's the motor at the boat's stern. Seek your heart's desire. If you are passive about it, find out why. What is the call that you're not answering? What is too frightening for you to look at in the face and move into? Break through. No matter how bad it gets, if you have your desire, you have everything you need. Ask, seek, knock. You won't be denied. It's a promise, and we can take it to the bank. Let's pray. Father, just want to take a moment here and let things sink in. It is beyond comprehension what you are offering us. It's too good to be true, and so we think it is. By our lights, things like this don't happen. But Father, we want to trust you. We want to move into you. We want to take Jesus' words at face value, hang on them, trust them, and move out as if these things are already true. Help us to face whatever fears we have, whether they're spoken or unspoken, conscious or subconscious, and to move through, to stoke our heart's desire, to let it take us wherever it takes us, to find the beginning at the end of our journey and know what that means for the first time. All these things are possible in you. Everything is possible in you. Help us to continue to break through every barrier, using our desire as our guide. We want you, Lord. We want your love. We want the understanding of what our relationship is. Thank you. Thank you. In Jesus' name, amen.